Welcome to Local Motion. This is Allie Lightfoot. Today we'll be hearing some top-scoring writers from the Write On Anthology competition. They'll be reading their published works. Write On is an annual writing competition for Delta County writers. Readers this evening will include Marty Derlin, Slater Podgorny, Carol Kwiatkowski, and Sarah Gilman. Here's the director of the Blue Sage Center for the Arts, Annette Pretorius, to introduce our first reader.
First up, we have Marty Derlin, and maybe you saw her play here over the last month. Yay! A great writer with many talents, Marty Derlin.
Well, this is from the first chapter of a novel, probably my fourth or fifth novel I've attempted. It was inspired by our town. A Quirk of Fate, Chapter 1. You might have driven by Adobe, Colorado on your way to a more glamorous location like Aspen, Crested Butte, or Telluride. If so, you probably entertained a fleeting thought about the area's beauty and serenity. So far off the beaten track, you might have said to yourself as you sped past the two-lane blacktop leading to town. But if you should take that turn and cross the bridge over the muddy river, often like its name but sometimes clear as crystal, you'd find yourself winding gently through apple and peach orchards with two great mountains towering above, snow-capped in winter, blue as blue in summer. And then as the road turns into First Street, you'd see the public library on the left, and Susan's Liquors on the right welcome you to Adobe. How very handy. That was Lila's unfailing thought as she hobbled from the library across the street to the liquor store. Her two favorite things had been situated right next to each other, either by happenstance or design. She was pelted by a sleety mix already sticking to the pavement. Indian summer was definitely over, and winter was overtaking what was left of a long and luxurious fall. The street was already slickish, but her trusty hand crutches helped her reach the other side intact. One serious fall per lifetime was enough, surely. She pushed open the heavy glass door and stepped inside the warmth. Susan was behind the counter, glumly working the New York Times crossword. Her long white hair, alternating between waves and ringlets, was wild as usual, and she was wearing an outlandish flowered dress. That dress makes me think of the curtains my mother hung in our trailer in Florida when I was 9 years old, Lila said. Funny you should say that, said Susan. I got it to ward off the gloom and entice the sun. Working great, isn't it? Lila was about to frame a question about what Susan's spiderweb earrings were meant to be warding off or enticing when a new customer entered the store. He was a stranger, dressed in hunter garb. No surprise there. Lila noticed a pickup with a covered bed in the parking lot. He chose a 12-pack of cheap beer from the cooler and asked for a pint of cheap bourbon from behind the counter. Lila examined his profile as he paid with a $50 bill. For some reason, he looked familiar. She knew pretty much everyone in the town of 1500. And she tried to smile at him, but he barely gave her a glance. He left in a hurry, after counting his change carefully. "Hmm," said Susan, looking after him as the pickup wheeled out of the lot, heading toward Main Street. "He looks like a rustic," said Lila. The rustics were everywhere in the area, having settled in Adobe when the coal mines up the valley first opened. I was thinking Shay, said Susan. Well, they intermarried, said Lila. I'm sure, responded Susan absently. There was a silence as she stared at the crossword. Lila waited. Okay, five-letter word, beginning with H-A. Well, I should say maybe beginning with H-A. Stop. Is this today's puzzle? Yes. You know I have it waiting at home. I don't want a preview. I want to approach it as a virgin. Oh, for God's sake, all right. They had this interchange fairly often, and it always annoyed Susan. She put down the crossword. So, the usual? Lila nodded. Susan went into the back room for the special stash of wine as Lila stood by the counter looking out the window. There were big flakes drifting down now, hitting Susan's gravel parking lot and coating the pebbles. A few cars went by before Susan emerged with a bottle of the Italian red. "Hey, want a glass in the back room?" asked Susan. The two often sat around her wood stove, talking and drinking wine, while Susan kept a lookout for customers. But Lila shook her head. It was supposed to snow several inches, and she longed for the comfort of her own living room, her fluffy cat, Eduardo, and the next Dorothy Sayers book waiting there in her bag, not to mention the crossword. "Okay," said Susan, handing her the bottle and taking the $10 bill Lila offered. She put the bill in the register and gave Lila $2 back. "See you soon." "Yep," said Lila. She put the bottle in her heavy bag, hoisted it up, and scrunched her hat down over her ears and put on her gloves. "See you soon." The blast of wind that hit her was a surprise. Wasn't it just a moment ago the flakes were lazily floating down? Now the snow was heavy and wet, and the wind was gusting. As she trundled through the gathering storm up First Street toward her house 5 blocks away, Lila was thinking about her job. She was a copy editor for the local newspaper, the Adobe Times, which came out only once a week. It was barely a living, and to make ends meet, Lila also wrote the weekly bulletin for the Catholic Church and freelanced occasionally. Of course, she was lucky to have any job at all as an editor, since she'd only attended a semester of college and had taught herself everything she knew. An autodidact is what she was. Weird word, and a lot of people had no idea what it meant. Even Susan, one of the most literary people in town, thought it had something to do with cars or masturbation. The Adobe Times was owned by an eccentric couple, the DeWitts. Tom was a former mathematics professor, and Jane was once a radio producer. Tired of the congestion and pace of New York City, they had made their home in funky Adobe decades ago, buying the paper cheap and turning it into their showcase. They'd hired Lila 12 years ago after she'd recovered, well, sort of, from the fall, but could no longer be a waitress. In her prayers and in the dark of night, Lila wondered if the fall was actually, quote, a blessing in disguise. Wasn't it good that she could no longer hustle up and downstairs schlepping drinks and foods, receiving practically nothing in exchange? And why had she settled for that in the first place? In any case, now she was a copy editor, still laboring for a lowly salary, often in pain from the smashed and fused vertebrae, but she had an office at the end of the hall in her own window looking out toward the mountains. Day after day, she proofed stories and ads, checked facts, and occasionally wrote an essay. But recently, her editor, that would be Jane, Tom assumed the title of publisher, had rejected her essays. Jane's objection was that Lila kept alluding to God. The DeWitts were Jewish, anti-religious, and Jane was anti-Catholic as a matter of principle. She was horrified at the idea of an infallible pope and priests who sexually abused children. "Can't you say the same thing without bringing religion into it?" Jane asked. "Just don't mention God. It really lowers the tone." But try as she might, Lila kept falling back on God, her God, because finally, a compassionate deity was all she had. Yes, there were her friends, her sister, the cat, beloved books, the New York Times crossword, but pain, poverty, and the state of the world made her cling to the benevolent God she had known since childhood, the God who was there as the family moved around the country. Her dad was in the Air Force, but not a college man. Thus, the family was usually in a substandard living situation. At each new school, Lila was obviously the weird new poor kid with the really weird twin. Her bipolar but beautiful mother couldn't help anyone, not even herself. So Lila learned to depend on the Catholic Church and the Catholic God and his compassionate son. Not so her sister Laurel, a child who declared herself an atheist and as an adult had become a Buddhist. None of her friends understood it except for maybe Irma, who ran the library and was also a Catholic. But Irma was able-bodied, had a decent salary in a normal family, and she wasn't devout, only dutiful. As Lila turned down Peach Street, a blast of Arctic wind nearly knocked her off her feet. The streets in Adobe were named after fruits and flowers: peach, pear, apple, nectarine, cherry, plum, peony, lilac, rose. From down the block, she thought she heard Eduardo's meows. Yes, as she got closer, forging through the blinding snow, she could hear him. She was almost home when she realized she wasn't hearing the neighborhood's most familiar sound, the dog next door barking. In every kind of weather and condition, the dog was always tied up in the backyard, and anyone or anything in range could set it off. She hated the dog, even as she felt sorry for it, and had tried to get the local animal rescue to take it away, but it hadn't happened. The neighbors, too, she viewed with disgust and pity. For years, she had tried to negotiate a truce with the cranky old patriarch. He had died last year and his family moved in, the angry son and his cowering wife, two scared little boys, and the neglected dog. Like Lila's, the house next door was one of the older ones in town. Originally little more than a shack, it was now a series of shacks, all stuck together, sprawling across the tiny lot. Lila's house, on the other hand, purchased with the money she'd been paid in recompense for her life-shattering injuries, was an old Victorian, upright and dignified, displaying a sense of purpose and design. She wasn't much of a housekeeper or a maintenance person, but the house still had a presence. She shuffled through her gate, poking it forward with her crutch through an inch or two of snow as the flakes flew into her face. Eduardo was huddled near the door, still meowing, incensed at the weather and, by extension, Lila for allowing it. She fumbled with the key. She had to keep it locked because of her sister Laurel, who unfortunately couldn't be trusted to observe the usual boundaries. As she opened the door, Eduardo bounded in ahead of her, making for his food dish. Ah, the house was warm. Her old rocker beckoned, with its nearby table loaded with books and a cold half cup of tea. She would get the kettle on for a new steaming pot of something soothing. She stripped off her wet coat, hat, and gloves, shed her crutches, sat on her stool, and laboriously took off her boots, then limped into the kitchen. Eduardo was in there gobbling crunchies, as if he hadn't just eaten that morning. She filled the tea kettle and put it on the stove and hobbled to the bathroom. Ever since the accident, her bladder wasn't what it used to be. The kettle was just beginning to boil when she came back to the kitchen, and she poured it into a pot over her favorite chamomile tea. By then, Eduardo had finished eating and was rubbing up against her legs. She was cooing and talking to him when she heard sirens. They were loud, coming closer, and it was shocking when they came right toward her. She struggled into the living room, parted the white curtains on her mullioned window, and saw a revolving red light right in front of her house. In fact, several. There were two police cars, an ambulance, and a fire engine parked in front, their bright lights illuminating the driving snow. The next reader is Slater Podgorny. He's the youth writer in this book.
Thank you. I'm going to read The Perfect Night. First they tell you nobody's perfect. Then they say practice makes perfect. I wish they'd make up their mind. Wilt Chamberlain. Everyone tells you that perfect isn't achievable. But what is perfect? Anything could be perfect. It could be perfect in the moment or as a life lesson. I'm going to tell you the story of a perfect night. It was a warm and sunny but bugless evening, and there was that amazing smell of baseball in the air. Everyone at the ball field was in a good mood. I was guest playing with the Fruit of Storm at a Montrose baseball tournament. We were playing in the championship game against the Grand Junction Gators. Our pitcher, a great friend of mine, had been throwing a perfect game, and we were crushing the team, hitting multiple homers. Everything was going well except for one thing. I was on the bench. Since I was a guest player, I had only participated in 4 of 21 innings that we as a team had played. I was disappointed about this, but my dad reminded me that I had to earn the chance to play, and I hadn't gotten that opportunity yet. In the fourth inning, our coach took out our second baseman and put me in. I stepped up to the plate. Swing and a miss. That's one. Swing and a miss. That's two. Swing and a miss. Strike three, you're out. That was the last out of the inning. We took the field. As I mentioned, our pitcher was throwing a perfect game. This is the point when you would sacrifice your life to make sure that ball doesn't touch the ground in the outfield. First pitch, ground ball right at me. I make the play and throw to first. That's one. Second pitch, ground ball between first and second. I make a diving play and throw to first on my knees. That's two. Third pitch, ground ball up the middle. I range to my right and make the backhanded play. Three outs on three pitches. A perfect inning. The game was over. Instead of the team going to congratulate the pitcher, everyone came running to me, including the pitcher. During the presentation of trophies, my team took the plaque to a huddle. And my teammates were saying, "Are we going to give it to him? And when are we going to give it to him?" I was wondering, who are we going to give it to? Then the team handed me the plaque and said, "This is for your dad." A few months earlier, my coach and mentor, had been diagnosed with ALS, a disease without a cure. I walked over to my dad in tears with my team behind me. When I handed him that plaque and we embraced in a hug, I'm pretty sure that everyone witnessing this magical moment was either crying or trying not to. That's when I realized how perfect that night was. No one knew how close I was to my dad or how much it meant to me to give him that plaque, but it didn't matter. It was perfect. After I handed him the plaque, he looked over the field and said, "Wow, look at that sky." It had changed to a mix of orange and pink, so bright and beautiful that I felt magic had to be involved. The only thing that could take our eyes off this most beautiful horizon was the perfect moment occurring right in front of our eyes. Although many of the fans didn't know my dad or me, they were still cheering. Even the losing team wasn't mad that night. In all eyes, perfect is different, but in my eyes, this was a truly perfect night. Without my dad, this night would not have happened. Between the countless hours he spent with me at the batting cage and the countless hours he spent coaching my team, he must have hit me over 100,000 ground balls and thrown me over 200,000 pitches. These hours and many more that we spent together formed me into the person I am now, and I can't thank him enough for that. I truly did have a perfect dad. Thank you.
So the next reader is Carol Kwiatkowski, and she's going to read A Touch of Tourette's.
So I saw in the anthology that this is billed as a nonfiction, so those of you who know me are going to wonder, who the heck is Ben? But names have been changed to protect the identity of the young. That's all I'll say. This is called A Taste of Tourette's. Before having children, I held positions at a corporate law firm, a major national phone company, and a university medical school. But being a mother is the hardest job I've ever had. I had a pretty regular bedtime routine with my one-year-old son, Ben, whose white blonde hair, blue eyes, and fuzzy red footy pajamas never failed to bring a smile to my face. But lately, he developed a curious habit. After his bedtime story, he would flop onto his belly and lay still for a moment, then bounce up to his knees and reach for his water bottle on the windowsill. Instead of asking for Wawa, he grunted, and pointed like an ape. I handed him the water, and he leaned down to drink from the straw as if he had no hands. He did this 6 or 8 times before pulling up the covers to his chin, my signal that he was ready for sleep. Although tedious, it was so cute, I indulged him as many times as he liked. It seemed harmless enough, and I had a hard time denying him water. My husband would argue I had a hard time denying him anything. A few nights ago, 3 rounds into his routine, Ben turned and laid on his side, his back toward me, and began making loud slurping noises. What was he doing? Smacking his lips, licking his chops, whatever it was, he was doing it with gusto. When he bounced up to kneeling position, instead of grunting for water, he rolled his wet little knuckles in circles around my lips. I laughed at his goofiness. Ben, what are you doing? He flopped onto the pillow and began the wet sucking noises again. Then up for another round of kneading my lips. Oh no, I thought, not another addition to his nightly routine. I started to chuckle again when I caught the look in his eyes. Dilated in the dark, two black holes stared back, intent on their target, my mouth. Clearly he was on a serious mission. I stifled my laugh out of respect. How true the saying is, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. In my family, we have a few mild cases of Tourette syndrome, an inherited condition characterized by repetitive behaviors, sometimes with obsessive compulsiveness. TV characters with Tourette syndrome are always extreme, displaying a comical variety of bodily tics and barking obscenities uncontrollably. Few people have ever seen such a person, although Tourette's is much more common than most people think. The majority of cases are too mild to notice, and most kids simply grow out of it. Nonetheless, I lay in bed that night, plagued by my own obsessive thoughts. Is Ben's nighttime routine a sign of Tourette's? Or perhaps a compulsive behavior like the TV character Monk, who can't leave his house without flipping the light switch 18 times? I wondered what other strange behaviors he might have that we excused as merely quirky. He did have that funny little habit when he was younger, where he swung his head to the side as if to bury his chin in his shoulder. The movement reminded me of a shy child asked to greet a stranger. But Ben was never shy, and he did it randomly, as far as I could tell. He also got extremely frustrated when I did some small thing he didn't like. A few days ago, we came in from playing on the swing, and I started to unzip his jacket. He squirmed away, screaming, "No, no, 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 no!" Okay, he didn't want his jacket off yet. Fine, I zipped it back up again. No, he wailed. It was too late. I had ruined everything. When frustrated like this, he sometimes flew into a tantrum, flinging himself to the ground and crying so hard he turned blue. He would pass out for a fraction of a second before gulping a huge breath of air and coming to. An eerie calm followed, then in defeat, a wail of self-pity. Until now, these behaviors had been explained, if not excused, as, well, that's Ben. Lying in bed, I began stringing them together, fearfully asking, does my son have Tourette syndrome? By the next morning, I had my own full-blown obsession. The look in Ben's eyes haunted me until I had time to consult my primary care physician, the internet. I searched everything I could think of, Tourette syndrome, obsessive compulsive disorder, symptoms in infants, treatments. At one point, my husband came in while I was searching. I refrained from saying anything, partly to preserve a bit of hope that my fears were overblown. Also, I loved him too much to plant in him the seed of fear that was growing in me like a weed. My husband would never forgive me for making him look at our son with a new set of emotions, concern, sadness, pity. Finally, I'm a firm believer in the power of the self-fulfilling prophecy. The last thing we needed was the whole family pandering to the ranting of a bad-tempered child for fear of upsetting his delicate psyche, a psyche I had invented one day and brought to fruition through the subtle power of belief. When my husband poked his head into my office, I quickly hit the home button on the computer and smiled cheerily. "What's up, honey?" Returning later to my search, I was dismayed at finding nothing on Tourette symptoms in toddlers. Most cases seemed to be diagnosed in older children. Well, I told myself, I'm picking up very subtle cues. Few people are as sensitive as I am to their young children's idiosyncrasies. A woman on a mission has unmatched powers of rationalization. I found myself following a lead toward parent management training, a program for parents to learn how to manage their child's oppositional behavior. It was effective with Tourette's, which confirmed my hunch of a link between Tourette's and tantrums. I printed an article and jotted down the title of a popular book. When my husband popped in again, I couldn't help myself. Without mentioning Tourette's, I told him I found a program that might help us deal with Ben's tantrums. I was confident we could create an environment where Tourette's couldn't get a toehold, much less flourish. I left the computer with a sigh of relief. Lying in bed that night, staring up at the glow-in-the-dark stars on his ceiling, my worst fears resurfaced. If Ben did have Tourette's, how would it affect his life? He was such a sweet, fun-loving boy. My heart broke at the ruthless teasing I imagined him enduring. I remembered the boy in my first grade class who stuttered and how cruelly we mimicked him. Such were my thoughts as Ben began his nightly routine. Crash face down into the pillow, rest, bounce up and grunt for water, crash again. I thought about the website that cautioned against suppressing obsessive behaviors, as the pent-up frustration would surely vent itself elsewhere. I indulged his repeated requests for water. Then he began the sucking noises again. That and the face kneading were the behaviors that had jump-started my crusade. Overnight, they changed my cute little boy into a child with a syndrome. After a minute or two of slurping, I couldn't hold back any longer. Ben, what in the world are you doing? He rolled over and offered me his fist. I stared at him quizzically, and he took his hand back. This time I could see that he was licking enthusiastically, poking his tongue in between his fingers, his eyes smiling intensely. He looked back at me and offered it again. As only a mother would do, I tentatively stuck out my tongue and licked the crease between his knuckles. Dumbstruck, I lay still as my mind wrapped itself around reality and my body tried to absorb the rush of mixed emotions. Surprise, relief, even guilt at the runaway train of my fears. Now see, I could stop right there. I only thought about that as I was sitting here. Okay. I chuckled softly and licked again. Sure enough, I tasted the sticky sweet cherry flavor of the heart-shaped lollipops I bought last week. His father, strict disciplinarian that he is, had been giving Ben one every time he asked, including just before bedtime. A huge sigh overwhelmed me. My son did not have Tourette's. He was not obsessive compulsive. He was merely savoring a juicy bedtime snack. And he was more than happy to share it with me, a mother who could be a little more particular when cleaning his hands, a mother just trying to make it through one more day on the job. And for the finale, we have the infamous Sarah Gilman reading The Ice Field.
Just by way of introduction, last summer I went on an expedition with a friend of mine who you all know well, Craig Childs, the author. And neither of us had any real experience with a glacier, and we were headed to the largest one in the United States. The Harding Ice Field is 700 square miles, has more than 30 glaciers pouring off of it. It's on the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. And we were rather blasé about the ropes, as it turned out. Anyway, so this is a poem about that experience. It is in the place the blue light slopes away. I follow its descent alone, each step spilling quieter as the snow steepens, curls down into cloud that laps over and blots out the sky, that sucks back down the glacier, that swims in again, as in breathing, as in waiting, as in tide. Each time it blinks away, it uncurtains a river that scrawls from ice into open air, then folds beneath its streaked and jumbled cascade, its 3,500-foot fall to a half-remembered valley blooming from yellow to green. This is a vein of coldest blood, and below it, every crack and fissure is full to drowning. The air leaves me when I see the way the snow at the edge heaves over itself, heaves over what's hidden beneath, its ribs and cracked knuckles slanting to a hard grip there in the bluer depths, light crushed inside a fist. It moves as we, but its time is different, slow and hunting. And I call for the others bent over the map, weighted with rocks against the shivering wind, and try to tell them, I can't go. I can't cross. Because this is our safest crossing. This bridge that hums thin to breaking with rills of water, scrapes the skin from stone and rolls over mountains. And all that whiteness beyond, sleeping flesh over restless bones. We go late in gray twilight, dip into that beating heart reach and retreat of fog, rise from its milky pull as if to breathe. And it's my breath I hear over the so silent roar of this nothing, over the crunch of our boots in each other's tracks, over the murmuring snow, cupping blue eyes at the closing sky. And it's my voice they hear, flagging back in snatches of song as we pass beneath avalanche chutes, over crevasses blanketed deep by the last storm, over whatever stirred dreamer lays beneath the ancient weight of this ice. And like this, I rise onto the vastness of the ice field, carried by half-remembered verses, each blurring into the next. Under that burning ether that falls down on these walls, burning my arms. This is the story of your red right ankle, how it came to meet your leg. Down by Yawkerville River, slow, silent, thick, and black, we stared into the water, and the water, it stared back. So that when I lift my face finally, peel my eyes wide to wind that paints tears across my temples, I realize it is I who have been asleep while all the world is bright awake.
You've been listening to some readers from the annual Write On Anthology, an annual competition for Delta County writers. Tune in to Local Motion in the coming weeks for more selections from this anthology. Stay tuned. Coming up next, One Woman's Perspective.